You've just tuned into Outdoor News Radio, a weekly showcase of the top outdoors writers and experts in Minnesota and across the region. I'm Outdoor News Managing Editor Rob Dreeslein, and I'm honored to have you join us for the next hour as we break down hunting, fishing, and natural resources topics affecting your ability to recreate in the Western Great Lakes and beyond. Our guests might challenge you occasionally, but we promise to entertain you while we're at it. Don't go away, because if you love this state's fine outdoor scene, you'll love Outdoor News Radio. Today's show is brought to you by Ducks Unlimited, the leading conservation group for restoring habitat for waterfowl and all things wild to benefit the nation's hunters. Hey everybody, welcome to another week of Outdoor News Radio. I am Rob Dreeslein. We're going to spend the next hour with you talking all sorts of outdoor topics. I will kick off the segment, kick off the show with Mr. Tim Spielman, and then we'll have an interview with Ian Donovan, a dog trainer we interviewed out at Game Fair, and John Hansen from the DNR, Minnesota DNR. We'll talk to him a little bit about a bunch of these new fishing regs that are brewing around the state. Lesmeister and I will wrap up the show. As promised, though, here's Tim Spielman. Tim, welcome. You got out and did some berry picking, huh? That 'tis the season.
I knew there would be a lot. I didn't know how the crop would be, but compared to the berries that were in my garden, you know, the stuff I planted, that they're really outshining them this year. In fact, there are so many that I heard from someone who was doing some aerial survey in the spring that they saw these areas of white, these huge areas of white, and didn't know what it was, and they determined it was these wild blackberries when they were flowering. So I knew there'd be a bumper crop. It sort of surprises me. And again, I just have my backyard observations, but I read in the CO reports every single week, all summer long, about nuisance bears. And I don't know if people are really having an issue bringing in their garbage or their grilling, but of all the berries I've seen, there's maybe not acorns like last year, and they're probably not dropping much yet. But I really thought that the nuisance bear reports would go down some. Given that berry crop, I mean, that's right at the top of the list for bears, those and blueberries this time of year. But anyway, I don't know if the bears are taking advantage of it, but I am.
Good. I told you off air, my son drove up from central Wisconsin to my parents' place in southeastern Minnesota to go do exactly that. And yeah, and they went home with like 3 gallons. It's been a wet year, and wet years, at least down at my parents' place, when they have a lot of moisture, they have a bumper crop of berries. So you're right. I've been seeing a few acorns. I don't think we've got the acorn crop we did last year. I mean, last year was a bumper crop, right? It was crazy.
I thought about that last night. I just it occurred to me as I was throwing some arrows at a target that what's the acorn crop like? So I just walked around the yard to my most reliable, and there were some, but that crop last year, I hadn't seen that in 20, 30 years. So obviously we're not going to get that, but there's some out there, and I'm sure it'll be more variable this year. Last year it seemed like that bumper crop was pretty widespread. This year not so much, probably back to average.
Well, these are important points because, like you say, this food is critical to how black bears respond to baits. And that's, wow, Tim, that's just a week out, September 1st, huh? The black bear season is underway. And, of course, we got guys out baiting right now.
Yeah, they've lucked out this year. Again, my backyard observations are that the deer flies aren't as bad as they were a month ago. And it hasn't been that sweaty, hotty 90 degrees. I say that right about the time this weekend comes around, and it is. Sorry about that. But other than that, I think for the most part, it's been fairly comfortable baiting. And to me, that would, I know people love to do it, but that doesn't really appeal to me in the heat of summer. But they caught a break this year, and I think conditions have been pretty good for that.
And I think the long-range forecast shows cooler temperatures next weekend when bear hunting actually starts. So we'll see. I mean, it'd be nice for the bear hunters to have some cooler temps when they get out there. We should talk some news headlines, Tim. The big one for the second weekend in a row, we got some duck numbers. Last week we talked about Minnesota's numbers being down mostly, the theory being that the birds mostly bypassed Minnesota when it was dry. We had the early ice out, and we didn't have a lot of sheet water when the birds were coming north in, what, late March, April. Then the rain hit in May, June, July, and it was kind of too late for Minnesota. Do we dare say that it was not too late for the rest of the duck factory, and things are actually looking up, sounds like, continentally speaking?
Yeah, I think what the local folks were saying has been borne out a little bit, and that the ducks not finding water here continued on their merry way and nested elsewhere. It all, I suppose, balances out. If there's water to be found and ducks can get there, then we'll have good production. And just a couple numbers, mallard numbers were up over last year by 8%, which is always good to see. But as Tori notes in the story, they're still quite low compared to 20, 30 years ago. Widgeon increased by 55%, and green-winged teal were up 20%. So those were, scrop were up too, 16% in this federal survey. So those were the highlights.
Good to see mallards bouncing back a little bit. We've been talking about that you know, they're the bread and butter bird for a lot of water fowlers. So you see mallards down and you get worried. And so much of the regulations, right, are based on those mallard numbers. Mm-hmm. They're our most important populous duck. I'm an old diver guy. I hate to see the canvasbacks down, 8% from last year. They're below 4%, below the LTA long-term average. And a number of species, we should point out, I'm sorry to be pessimistic, but a number of species are below the LTA. Mallards, blue-winged teal, northern pintails, canvasback, and scaup, all below the long-term average. It's a good time to be a gadwall hunter, a widgeon hunter, a green-winged teal hunter. And redheads, you know, they're although they are down from last year, redheads, for some reason, you think they're almost just like a canvasback. Why are redheads up and canvasbacks down? But it's a good time to be a redhead hunter.
And we should probably point out, it's been going on for years, but these numbers are what will dictate not this year's waterfowl hunting regs, but next year's. So okay. Given these numbers, it's more than likely that we'll see another liberal season come next year. And as Tori points out in the story, based on all these years, I cannot figure out these strategies that the Fish and Wildlife Service uses for ducks for specific regulations. Of course, they change all the time, too, so that doesn't help matters. But Tori points out that it's likely that not this season, but the following season, the pintail harvest allowed bag limit would go up to 3. It's 1 this year, so don't forget that's 1 this year. But it's interesting that will probably change for the following season.
My theory, I can't remember if I told you this, Tim, if it was Les Messier or somebody else. My theory is that we're going to have a good waterfowl hunting season, that the drought for a couple of years settled these ponds out. A lot of aquatic vegetation took root, and it's growing vigorously. And now we got a lot of water on top of it. The ducks are going to fly over. They're going to look down. They're going to see all this water. They're going to land. They're going to gorge themselves on all this food. They're going to stick around, and that's going to mean good waterfowling for our duck hunters this fall. Now, we had a letter to the editor, someone who disagreed with that sentiment, seemed to think that, well, no, what happened was all these small ponds got choked out by bulrushes and other weeds. I don't know what your take is, Tim. I suppose there's some real small ponds where that's true, but I think there's enough water out there that it flooded some of this stuff back out, and I think that's going to be good.
I would think so. Again, you get a year like this with a lot of water in locations. It hasn't been nearly as wet as it was a month ago, but still, there's plenty of water around. But that heightens the necessity to scout, because ducks can be in a lot of locations.
Outdoor News Radio, Rob Jerisan with Tim Spielman, and we are kicking off this week's show. Tim, folks may have heard there's going to be an election this fall, and I must admit, until I saw the commentary on our opinion page, that I forgot. Arguably, the most important thing that people can vote for in Minnesota is extending the Environmental and Natural Resources Trust Fund another 25 years. That is on the ballot, and was it Matt Dahl from the Minnesota Environmental Partnership reminding everybody of that in a commentary in this week's edition?
Yeah, you don't see a lot of vote yes on the ENRTF signs in people's yards. So it does, yeah, it does slip your mind. It slipped my mind. That's when I saw that. I thought it was a really good commentary to run, just from the standpoint that it's a reminder that mm-hmm. it'll be there. And, mm-hmm. You know, the good it's been, or the good it's done, I should say. Matt went into some detail about some other items, how to improve it in his eyes. And so, yeah, read the commentary. I, you know, overall, I think it's it's been a real plus for the state, for the environment. It's done what it's supposed to do. So I hope we don't go too far off track someday and change what it's done. Again, the first word is environment. So there are folks these days that want to turn some of these programs into social type of benefit society, which is great. I mean, a good environment does that, but don't lose track of it, or don't lose sight of the fact that this is about the environment, not necessarily about us.
When we were pushing to get this back on the ballot, I think in 23, there were some concepts out there that talked about using some of this money for low-income housing or, you know, all sorts of other ideas. And so I'm really glad that what finally made the ballot is pretty clear, good language, still honors the original intent of the Environmental Natural Resources Trust Fund. When this thing originally passed, was it 1988, Tim? It's going back quite a ways. So we got an opportunity here to keep this thing going and keep it on the right path. And so, yeah, I will certainly be reminding folks about this vote on this program over the next several months. And I'm sure Tim and I will both mention in our column sometimes between now and the election, too. But let's get this one done. And then we can focus on the real big one, the state sales tax dedication, see if we can get that baby renewed here in, I guess, about 10 years. That's going to be the big one.
Yep, for sure.
Well, Tim, I think that'll do it. I think I'm out of time. I gotta move on to some other guests. But thanks for spending a segment with me, and enjoy what's left of summer.
Yeah, I will. You as well.
All right. Tim Spielman, editor at Outdoor News. Let's break. We'll be back. Talk a little dog training when we return. This is Outdoor News Radio.
Hunting season will be here before you know it, and it's time to get ready for your next adventure with the OnX Hunt app. Whether you're traveling in search of roosters, elk, waterfowl, or looking to score on a whitetail close to home, OnX Hunt can help you be more successful this season. Route, plan, and navigate with private and public land boundaries, recent imagery, offline maps, and Minnesota-specific hunt layers. Download the Hunt app on the App Store or Google Play and join the millions of hunters that trust OnX Hunt.
Our beautiful world is changing, withering, dying, by the hands of those who don't value nature, even though we all depend on it for life itself. But there is hope. Together with caring friends, the Nature Conservancy can restore our lands and save our wildlife with big solutions only nature can provide. To learn more, visit nature.org today.
Ready for your next fishing adventure? Look no further than Lake City, Minnesota. Located in southeast Minnesota, nestled along the shores of Lake Pepin, this charming town offers some of the best fishing in the Midwest. Whether you're a seasoned angler or just starting out, Lake Pepin is teeming with walleye, bass, and more. And when you're not on the water, explore Lake City's quaint shops, delicious dining, and scenic beauty. Go to visitlakecity.org today and plan your trip to Lake City, Minnesota's South Shore.
Looking for the perfect summer getaway? Look no further than Minnesota's own Lake of the Woods. Welcome to the walleye capital of the world, where the next hook set could be your personal best fish of a lifetime. But it's not just about the fishing. From cozy resorts to charming lodges, Lake of the Woods offers summer fun for everyone. Plus, our charters and expert fishing guides are ready to make your experience unforgettable. Discover the magic of Lake of the Woods. Visit lakeofthewoodsmn.com.
Since 1967, generations of Minnesota sportsmen have trusted Outdoor News to keep them up to date with the latest news, pro tips, features, fishing reports, gear reviews, and more. For less than a buck per week, you can carry on the tradition and join thousands of Minnesota sportsmen by subscribing to Outdoor News. Whether you prefer a printed copy in your mailbox each week or the convenience of up-to-the-minute news on your smartphone or computer, we've got you covered. Subscribe today at outdoornews.com/subscribe.
Hi, we're the Goo Goo Dolls. We're fortunate that our daughters have what they need to grow and learn. But that isn't the case for nearly 13 million kids in the U.S. that struggle with hunger.
Childhood hunger is a heartbreaking reality that Feeding America is working to change. Each year, the Feeding America network of food banks rescues billions of pounds of good food that would have gone to waste and provides it to families and children in need.
You can help kids in need in your community by visiting feedingamerica.org.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Outdoor News Radio. Rob Reeseline with you for another segment. Thanks so much for tuning in. As you can hear, we are broadcasting and recording live out of Game Fair 2024 at the Armstrong Ranch Kennels.
Mark Norquist, my friend, is co-hosting this segment with me. We've got a really cool guest now I'm excited to introduce.
Yeah, I'm excited to have this conversation with Ian.
Good. Yeah, I'm excited as well, guys. Thanks for having me.
That voice you hear is Ian Donovan. He is retired from the U.S. Army. He was a sergeant first class, currently based out of Clarksville, Tennessee, representing Kinetic dog food here. And you've got quite a dog training past. Thank you for your service, first of all, Ian. Thanks
Absolutely.
For joining us on the broadcast. Tell us about what you did in the U.S. Army. You were training dogs for the military, huh?
Yeah, so every Special Forces group's got a kennel attached to their group, and we staff those kennels with, you know, qualified Green Berets, because it's easier when we deploy with ODAs or Special Forces teams to have a qualified Green Beret run a dog with those teams. So toward the end of my career, I moved from being an assaulter on an ODA and went to the kennels, kind of still just chasing those combat deployments. Call those dogs combat tickets because they don't deploy them on training missions. They're specifically designed and going to be tasked with combat deployments. So yeah, we... At every group, there's a kennel, like I said, and those kennels are comprised of multi-purpose canines. They're called multi-purpose because they do three things. They track enemy personnel, footstep to footstep. We use them as a less than lethal means of enemy acquisition, which is just a fancy way of saying they're bite dogs. Okay. And then they're all explosive detectors. We don't care about drugs, you okay. know. Uh-huh. We're trying to find things that are going to maim and destroy the guys that are behind us because we're leading every element that's out there. My area of operation was the Middle East, and there was a pretty high bomb threat there. So we focused more on explosive detection than we did on the bite work side of it. Not that they couldn't do it. The dogs that we were utilizing primarily were Belgian Malinois and Dutch Shepherds. Not really a ton of German Shepherds. We needed the more athletic, agile, smaller dogs.
Okay.
And those dogs have no issue biting somebody.
Okay.
You know, they're herding breeds. They utilize their mouths and their eyes genetically. So we really hammered down on training them to use their nose to find explosives.
Ian, tell us a little bit about your background. Originally from Louisiana, why'd you get into Special Forces to start with? Originally, it wasn't canine work, right?
No, originally it wasn't. I was, a young single guy, and I was working in the oil field down south, and I'd always been a hunter, and an outdoorsman, a fisherman, a trapper, a tracker. I'd been obsessed with the pursuit of game my whole life, but I was working in the oil field, and that's an exciting job for a young guy. It's chasing a paycheck. It's hard work.
Good money, I bet.
Good money. Yeah. But I'd kind of maxed out the excitement level that I was experiencing there. So I've always been a patriot. I've always had a lot of pride in the country. So I decided to join the military. And when I did that, I wanted to join a specialized organization or group. And I had the opportunity to do that right off the street based off of some test scores physically and mentally that I was able to take. So that's how I ended up in the military. That's how I ended up in special operations. And then from there, kind of went. After gaining a lot of experience on the teams and as an assaulter, was able to take that experience and all the experience that I had, working and training hunting dogs and sporting dogs into that new job as a dog handler.
That special forces training is intense as we're made to believe among us civilians?
Yeah. It's not something I normally talk with civilians about because there's not a It's difficult to explain it to guys. We normally just speak to one another, guys that are in the same business
sure.
as us about that stuff. Because not that there's a lack of interest, but it's difficult to explain it.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, it's extremely difficult. But I will tell you, mental resiliency is everything.
Yeah.
Mental toughness is everything. And obviously, you've got to be physically strong and capable and tough. But your mind will tell your body things to do things that the body thinks it can't.
Uh-huh.
So it is. It's challenging, but it's a lot of fun.
I bet.
So one of the things you're going to be talking about is the similarity between military dogs and sporting dogs.
Yeah,
is that correct?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that was one of the things that allowed me to be successful as a multi-purpose dog handler, as a military dog handler, was my understanding of drives and instincts in hunting dogs, sporting dogs. My understanding of being able to read a dog's body language and communicate with that dog on the dog's level as opposed to expecting that dog to communicate on my level as a human being. Anthropomorphism is expecting a dog, to think like humans do, and that'll get, in the hunting world, your dog just won't perform as well. But in this world, in the military, I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you if we weren't really good at being able to train and work with these dogs and communicate with them. But yeah, a ton of similarities that I'll highlight today, both in the breeds that we utilize, the drives and instincts, but also in the training. A lot of things that I learned from real great mentors prior to the military and sporting dogs and hunting dogs, I was able to take to the military, and then after the military, things that I learned from legends in that world as dog trainers, I was able to take to my hunting world after.
So did your breed preference prior to military duty change when it comes to hunting?
No, not necessarily. I'll use any dog that's got the right drives and instincts. Sure. You know, I don't, it's funny because not a lot of guys do this, but I am a huge rabbit hunter. I've always had beagle hounds.
Yeah, and I love it.
In my group of guys that I hunt with, I'm the youngest by a lot, you know.
I bet.
But color doesn't run a rabbit. You know, there's a lot of different types of beagles, a lot of bloodlines. I select dogs for hunt drive as opposed to prey drive. That served me well in the military as well. We're trying to manipulate these dogs into doing something that they're not, they don't understand why they're trying to find this explosive odor. So to have the ability to go to work every day and understand that you're going to manipulate this dog to do something that it doesn't have any idea or has no, it doesn't enjoy doing it, but you're going to make it think that it's the most fun thing in the world to do, makes you a good dog trainer, I think. It allowed me to find success there for sure. But no, breed-wise, there are definitely breeds that are genetically predisposed and to do certain things. And yeah, if you're a smart guy, you're going to use those breeds, you know. I would rather use a retriever to retrieve than a pointer. Mm-hmm. I'd rather use a pointer to point than a retriever, you know, simple things like that. But as far as the dog that can do the job, I choose dogs that have high hunt drive.
What's the biggest mistake that most hunters make when they get a dog for the first time?
Well, it's probably the biggest mistake that every trainer makes. Every time you pull that dog out of a kennel, you've got to have a plan in your head and a goal that you want to accomplish for that training iteration, right? So whether that's a 5-minute iteration or a 30-minute iteration of training, you need to have a plan. Fail to plan, you can plan to fail, right? So just making sure that you're a professional and everything that you do is pretty important. And if you're going to put the time and the energy and effort and the finances into a dog for hunting, then it behooves you to put a little brain into it as well. So have a plan, enact that plan. You know, every time I go to the range with my guys, we don't just go out there and start shooting. There is a deliberate plan that we're going to put into action to reach an objective or a goal. And I take that attitude into dog. But that, I think, is probably the biggest mistake that most guys make.
Ian, we need to get wrapped up here because I guess you got a seminar coming up. We want to be clear so that folks can hear you out. Do you do seminars all over the country? You've been doing a lot of this?
You know, this is the first time that I'll ever just be speaking off the cuff.
I think you're going to be a natural.
Well, in my world, you had to give a lot of briefs. I'm fluent in Arabic.
Wow.
And Special Forces, you got to be fluent in another language. So speaking to people is not an issue. Trying to keep from using acronyms that are used in the military and breaking down things to civilians may be a little bit of a challenge, but I love the opportunity to speak to guys, you know, like yourselves and the people in this audience today, because I'm not just speaking for myself, and we're very, very thankful for the support that the general community and the public and the hunting community gives guys like us, because, man, amongst our ranks, we're all hunters. We're just trying to be the best at it we can be, but yeah, this is not going to be a PowerPoint presentation like I'm used to giving on nutrition.
Okay.
But it will be a pretty in-depth discussion.
Well, for folks who would like to hear more about Ian Donovan, we haven't had a lot of time. Outdoor News had a very thorough story. Ron Husvet wrote in this week's print version. You can see it at outdoornews.com, too. So please check that story out. I got to ask, what do you make of Game Fair? This is kind of a unique event in the entire country. Giving it a thumbs up so far?
Yeah, for sure. I think it's a pretty cool event. I like these outdoor events.
You like the weather.
I'd love the weather, man. I can't get enough of this stuff. But I've been to events all over the place, and I do like the layout of this. I like the fact that people can bring their dogs and interact with these vendors out here. I think it's going to be a pretty successful event for everybody.
Well, you've got a very approachable way about yourself. I suspect you're going to have a very long career
at Kinetic and
doing seminars. And he's got a lot less gray in his beard than you and I
do. He does.
So he's got a long, great career coming. It's been a pleasure getting to know you.
Absolutely. You guys, too. Thanks for having me.
Good luck with your seminar. Okay. I think it's going to be a hit. Well, we thank Ian Donovan for spending a segment with us. Mark, thanks for knocking out a few seconds with me. It's good to see you again.
Great to be here with you, Rob, as always.
Yeah, our old buddy Mark Norquist, Modern Carnivore. Check out the modcarn.com website and podcast.
With that, let's grab a break. More Outdoor News Radio after these messages.
Is a trip to Alaska on your bucket list? It's time to dump that bucket and buy your ticket. And while you're there, fish the Kenai River with Jason's Guide Service. Jason is considered the best when it comes to catching Alaskan salmon, rainbow trout, and char. He's one of only a few guides that has the permit to fish in the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge, where the salmon are easy targets and the trout and char are plentiful. So cross that Alaskan fishing trip off your list and check out jasonsguideservice.com. That's jasonsguideservice.com.
Fort Dodge, Iowa? Outdoor and entertainment adventures are awaiting you. Discover Iowa's largest off-highway vehicle park, Gypsum City OHV Park, with 60 miles of trails, mudding areas, tracks, and an obstacle course. The area also boasts water, paved mountain bike, and equestrian trails. Head into town to enjoy public art and studios, an orchard, aquatic center, and family entertainment venue. Fill up with excellent Korean cuisine, pizza, ice cream, craft beer, or local wines. For more information, visit DodgeTheOrdinary.com.
Attention hunters, are you ready to take your hunting game to the next level? OutdoorNews.com is your ultimate hunting partner. Stay up to date with the latest hunting trends, gear reviews, and expert tips from seasoned hunters. OutdoorNews.com provides the most comprehensive hunting news to ensure you're always in compliance with local laws. Whether you're a seasoned pro or a beginner, OutdoorNews.com is for you. We're passionate about preserving our hunting heritage and fostering responsible hunting practices. OutdoorNews.com, where hunters become legends.
Okoboji, Iowa has thousands of acres of lakes for fishing and public land for hunting, making it Iowa's best outdoor playground all year long. Start planning your next trip to Okoboji for fishing, hunting, swimming, or camping in one of our state parks. When you get off the water, enjoy our many locally owned restaurants and attractions, making Okoboji a favorite destination for your entire family. Plan your next trip at vacationokoboji.com. Okoboji, Iowa's best outdoor playground.
Thinking about buying or selling rural real estate in Minnesota? Whitetail Properties Real Estate is the premier brokerage for buying or selling hunting land, farmland, and country homes. With local professionals and a national presence, no other brokerage can provide you with the same buying or selling experience as Whitetail Properties. To learn more about the current real estate market or connect with your local land specialist, stop by their booth at the upcoming Minnesota Deer and Turkey Classic or visit whitetailproperties.com.
The possibility of lung cancer can be pretty scary, especially if you're one of approximately 8 million current or former smokers at high risk. That's why SaveByTheScan.org wants you to know that now there's a breakthrough low-dose CT scan that can detect lung cancer early, and it only takes 60 seconds. You stop smoking, now start screening. For an easy quiz to see if you're eligible, visit SaveByTheScan.org. It could save your life. SaveByTheScan.org is brought to you by the American Lung Association's Lung Force Initiative and the Ad Council.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Outdoor News Radio. Rob Gerisline, happy to be with you for another segment. Hope you like the broadcast. If you do, check us out online at OutdoorNews.com. We've got a strong digital version you can subscribe to there, or you can also subscribe to print at OutdoorNews.com. You can also give us a call at 800-535-5191 or stop out at the State Fair and visit our booth. Corner of Judson and Nelson, right behind the DNR stage. Come on out, get a free copy of the paper, and subscribe while you are at it. Hey, speaking of the DNR, a gentleman has been willing to join us here for a segment. I appreciate that. His name is John Hansen. He's the agency's fisheries program consultant, and there's a bunch of experimental and special regs brewing, and John is here to talk to us a little bit about that. John, thank you. Yeah, the days are getting shorter, aren't they?
Yeah, all of a sudden it's flying by. We start getting notices about my kids' school starting up, and I'm realizing I haven't fished nearly as much as I had planned on, but that's how things go.
You know, it's not looking brutally hot here in the forecast, and so I'm hoping maybe that means some cooler water temperatures going into fall and maybe some fall fishing, good fall fishing. We got that two walleye bag limit on Lake Mille Lacs, so some good opportunities out there. So, John, pretty much every year the agency takes a look at experimental and special regs around the state, doesn't it? Can you kind of give us a quick 30,000-foot overview of how this process unfolds every year?
Sure, of course. It's one of our probably most present tools that folks see besides stocking. And yes, every year we go through a process where it's kind of part of our lake management planning process where our staff look at all the data they have from a lake and what the management plan is calling for and if we're meeting objectives or not. And if they think a regulation, special regulation, so that means it's basically different than the statewide regulation. If they think that that might help meet the objectives of the plan, then they'll propose either a special or experimental regulation. And I can explain a little bit of the difference to that if you want.
Yeah. What's the difference between experimental and a special reg?
Yeah, it's a good thing to clarify because people kind of sometimes even I will collectively call them special, but there is a specific difference. But experimental regulation is a situation where we don't have an established option that would fit the situation in what we call our regulation toolboxes. So each one of our kind of primarily managed species has this thing called a toolbox where we have non-statewide regulations that are kind of our canned options for different scenarios. And if they meet those criteria, then that's a pretty clear fit. But in some situations, either because we don't have a toolbox or there's a unique situation in a lake where one of the options that is in the toolbox isn't really going to work, we think, we do, we try out an experimental regulation, which the name implies it's somewhat more experimental. We don't have as much information on it. And the big practical difference is that those experimental regulations, if we use that option, those have an actual end date in rule. Whereas the special regulations don't have a set end date. We do evaluate them, but the experimental ones tend to be a 10-year, sometimes a 15-year end date that will expire unless we do something with them.
So in total, it looks like we got, what, about 14 or 15 lakes?
Yep, we got 15 lakes. You know, some are chains, so it's kind of, you know, how do you call a lake? But yeah, we got about, it's a kind of a normal batch of regulation proposals across, you know, a smattering of areas.
Well, let's drill into the drama a little bit as you and I were talking a little bit off here. And I'm reading from the DNR website here. One set of proposed regulations is in response to growing angler concerns about crappies and the increased stress on these fish populations from winter fishing, exacerbated by advanced technology that lets anglers go and easily find and catch fish. This is something that's been in the media a little bit for the past couple of years, you know, talking about added pressure from forward-facing sonar and other technology. There's, you know, technology has been a growing phenomenon for years, even before forward-facing sonar, live sonar came along. There have been other agencies around the country that are starting to address this. The situation down in Mississippi got a fair amount of press a couple weeks ago. Basically, what the agency wants to drill into what a lower limit might mean for crappies and their size structure on what a bunch of lakes, mostly in the Otter Tail, Fergus Falls area?
Yeah, that's correct. So there's a lot here, right? And we can go into the forward-facing sonar questions for sure. And it's kind of part of this, but not really directly driving it. It's just sort of one of the many factors that's driving some of the interest in doing more with our crappie management. And, you know, we had over the last couple, starting in 2021, we did that big push with our Quality Sunfish Initiative, where we put, you know, 150 special regulations on lakes. And on some of those, we added some crappie regulations, but it wasn't really explicitly part of that package. But that was really successful. And folks now are kind of, particularly our we have a panfish work group that's made up of citizens who provide input on lots of different things we do. And they're really interested in doing more with crappie because of these reasons that people are seeing these really popular winter crappie fisheries. And there are concerns that the efficiency is getting better. Anglers are getting way better at finding those basin crappie because of things like, you know, forward-facing sonar and just general advancements and comfort when you're out there on the ice. So there's a lot of different factors pushing us in this direction of saying, hey, let's look more at crappie, figure out if there are any issues. And in these Otter Tail County lakes, there's a batch of lakes that for a while they've been working on where there's been decent amount of pressure, kind of almost to a concerning level. Some of it's really focused pressure from some guides out there. And so a lot of anglers in that area are saying they're worried about the crappie quality kind of knocking back, and whether or not that's been shown is sometimes not super clear, but there is a lot of concern. And we honestly haven't evaluated a lot of these crappie bag limit reductions as much as we would like. It is one of our toolbox options, and it's, you know, makes sense in some of these situations to reduce the bag and try to sort of draw out some of that quality and distribute some of that harvest. But we don't have as much data as we want on some of these. And so they're being proposed as a special regulation because it is in our toolbox, but we are going to take a bit more of a deeper dive in evaluating those and making sure they're doing what we want. In particular, it's going to be coupled with a research project, which I can touch on a little bit, that's really trying to figure out, kind of refine that toolbox option where we say, you know, not all lakes are created equal. So in some lakes and some populations with certain type of, you know, what we call population dynamics, like growth and recruitment and mortality, a reduced bag limit might make sense. And in others, it's doesn't make much sense. It's not going to do any good.
Because crappies might not live as long in those lakes.
Correct.
Right?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. So, and we could go into a little bit, and that's kind of the leading thought of, you know, That's the biggest criteria that we look at with these special regs is what's the mortality. If it's really high mortality, natural mortality in particular, if they're just going to die anyway, you know, from natural causes and they're not going to live very long, we don't really want to overregulate and limit the number of fish unnecessarily that anglers can keep because they just die from natural causes anyway.
So, John, if you do implement this experimental reg on these lakes, how long would it go? Ballpark, is this something that you would monitor and test for 5 years or 10 years?
Yeah, so the crappie ones, our classic minimum that we say when we actually put an experimental regulation in and put an end date on it is 10 years. But honestly, that's sometimes not quite long enough. But with these crappie regulations, they are going to go in as a special regulation, so there's not going to be an end date. But we will start looking at them in a couple, 3 years. They're on a rotation of surveys. So in 5 years, we'll probably do a check-in. But depending on, again, how long they live, it takes a while and a couple of generations for us to see any sort of response. And so we probably won't make any sort of conclusions based on whether or not these are working until close to, you know, at least 10 years, unfortunately.
Well, it is what it is. We're dealing with living creatures here. And if we put this into place, if the public agrees we want to do this, it would start when? Did you say March 1st of 2025?
Correct. Yep. With all these proposals, it's always the year before we propose them and then take public input, which I encourage folks to do right now.
So this is something that could begin to have some effect even this winter. I mean, in a typical winter, not so much this past year, there's good crappie fishing. You know, after March 1st. In fact, you could argue there's a fair amount of panfish pressure then because the walleye and pike seasons have closed. So the people who are still on the ice are targeting these big panfish. Tell us about the public review process. Like you say, there's a number of ways for the public to weigh in on this proposal. Again, they can go to outdoornews.com, read all about it, and the DNR website's got a press release and a specific page devoted to this so they can get all the gory details. But there's a number of ways people can comment.
Yep, that's right. And so there's at any one of these lakes that we have a proposal on, there should be a sign posted there saying we're proposing some change. And it has contact information for the area office, and it should have a QR code that you can just, you know, point your smartphone at, and it'll get you right to this webpage you referenced, Rob. And on that webpage, you can find the list of proposals and then information about the open house. Each one of these things, we have to have a public meeting to take input. And so our staff from each area office will be at those open houses or public meetings, answering questions and taking comments. And also on that webpage, we have a online survey where you can go in and answer and indicate your support for each one of these. In the central office, too, I will be hosting an open house where I'll be taking comments on September 9th at 11:30. You can email me at jon.hansen@state.mn.us. Or you can call me at 651-259-5239.
So that's John Hansen with John with no H and Hansen with an E at state.mn.us. The online survey is available through Friday, October 7th, so still quite a bit of time if folks want to chime in on that. It looks like most of these public meetings are going to run from, they start Tuesday, September 10th through Thursday, September 24th, like you say, well, other than that Metro meeting, which is on September 9th.
Yep, and I would also encourage folks, especially if they have questions about kind of the justification or clarification, what the proposal is trying to do, to reach out to the area office and ask them specific questions. They're the experts who know, you know, the biology and the angling dynamics and all the background behind these things.
Yes, and you and I focused on the crappie regulations, but there's a bunch of others. There's walleye regs on Saginaw and Seagull Lakes. There's catfish up on the Osage River chain, and a number of others. So please check that out. There might very well be a lake in your part of the state where you'll want to chime in. John, thanks a lot for spending a segment with me. Good luck with this. I'm sure we'll stay in close touch and have a lot of questions as the process unfolds.
Yeah, thank you, Rob. Really appreciate the attention and always happy to chat.
That was John Hansen from the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. He is the agency's fisheries program consultant, talking about special and experimental regulations, which will be unfolding perhaps as early as next year. There's a lengthy public review process underway right now. With that, let's grab a break. More Outdoor News Radio after these messages.
Looking for the perfect summer getaway? Look no further than Minnesota's own Lake of the Woods. Welcome to the walleye capital of the world, where the next hook set could be your personal best fish of a lifetime. But it's not just about the fishing. From cozy resorts to charming lodges, Lake of the Woods offers summer fun for everyone. Plus, our charters and expert fishing guides are ready to make your experience unforgettable. Discover the magic of Lake of the Woods. Visit lakeofthewoodsmn.com.
I spent a lot of time in the garage, but even more time in the rain and mud. In 95, I helped tow your moving trailer. And in 09, it was sparks from me, your chains, dragging behind your truck that accidentally started a wildfire.
Spark a change, not a wildfire. Visit SmokeyBear.com, brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council.
Only you can prevent wildfires.
Ready for your next fishing adventure? Look no further than Lake City, Minnesota. Located in southeast Minnesota, nestled along the shores of Lake Pepin, this charming town offers some of the best fishing in the Midwest. Whether you're a seasoned angler or just starting out, Lake Pepin is teeming with walleye, bass, and more. And when you're not on the water, explore Lake City's quaint shops, delicious dining, and scenic beauty. Go to visitlakecity.org today and plan your trip to Lake City, Minnesota's South Shore.
Since 1967, Outdoor News has been Minnesota's go-to news source for all things out of doors. Generations of hunters and anglers have welcomed Outdoor News into their home each week, enjoying the most up-to-date news, features, columnists, fishing and hunting reports, gear reviews, and much, much more. For less than a dollar a week, you can join thousands of other Minnesota sportsmen and continue the long-standing tradition of subscribing to Outdoor News. Both print and digital versions are available. Start your subscription today at outdoornews.com/subscribe.
Every 2 seconds, someone special needs blood. A friend, a family member, a coworker. Someday, it could be you. In fact, right now, patients in local hospitals are relying on Memorial Blood Centers to be there with the blood they need to survive. And that means we're relying on you to step up and make a life-saving difference. Make a date to help save a life. Visit mbc.org today to make an appointment to donate blood. That's mbc.org.
Hi, I'm Smokey Bear, and I made an assistant to help you prevent wildfires.
Dude, I've got this. I've been camping since I was 5 years old.
But I am a camping influencer.
You know what? I'll bet you $5. Assistant Smokey, what is the best way to put out a campfire?
To put out a campfire, drown with water, stir, drown again. Then make sure the fire is out cold by feeling with the back of your hand.
Wait, really?
I'll take the $5.
Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council.
Hey folks, welcome back. Final segment of this week's broadcast of Outdoor News Radio. Going to wrap it up here with Tim Lesmeister. Thank you to Ian Donovan and John Hansen from the DNR who just joined us. I hope you like the broadcast. If you do, stop on out at our booth at the State Fair. Renew your subscription. Get a free hat if you renew at the State Fair or sign up for a new subscription right behind the DNR stage, corner of Judson and Nelson. You can also subscribe by calling 800-535-5191 or visiting us at outdoornews.com. Tim, welcome. Good to see you. Yeah, I just had John Hansen from the DNR. We talked a little bit about some of these new fishing regs. They got a lot of experimental regs out there, but I kind of honed in on the ones in my column that are focusing on crappie regulations and how that might be connected to technology a little bit.
Yeah, the forward-facing sonar, sure. That live sonar is definitely, it seems to be affecting the crappie population. And John Hansen was right. He said that every lake is different, and every lake has to be managed basically for a population of fish. So you can set up slots, you can do some things like that. And, of course, adjust your harvest levels, which I think is a really good idea. I've always been in favor of lower harvest levels, smaller limits for every species, because I think people go out there and they just whack too many of these fish when the fish are biting during certain times of the year. And so if a live sonar, a forward-facing sonar comes along and all of a sudden the DNR is saying, hey, let's adjust our limits, I'm all for it. I think we should give some relief to those that are buying sonar through tax credits. So you buy a forward-facing sonar because I want one in every boat if it's going to mean smaller harvest.
Yeah, I mentioned the fact that the state of Mississippi has reduced crappie limits on several reservoirs in the northern portion of that state. One thing I didn't get into with John Hansen was, but he and I talked about off-air, is there are a number of other states that are starting to delve into this in more detail. They're researching it. They're trying to understand what's going on. I think a lot of biologists are probably really concerned about muskies, Tim, maybe even more than crappies. The fact that, you know, there's deep water, deep nowhere muskies that no one was ever catching that all of a sudden everybody's finding. And those fish are being, you know, caught and released, but probably caught and released many times. Again, Hansen emphasizing, and I want to make sure I give due credit, that they're not out to ban any of these devices. And it, you know, this isn't going to happen overnight. I mean, this is typical DNR research. It might take 5, 6, 10 years before they draw some conclusions and actually, you know, change some limits as a result of this.
By that time, we'll be on to lures that are battery operated, that have little eye cameras that you can send down with remote control, and you can direct it right at the fish, give it a little wobble, a little wiggle, maybe send out some sonic waves. I mean, technology never ends. We don't know what's next. And by the time they figure out this forward-facing sonar, something else is going to come along, and they'll be making more adjustments, and they'll do more research. So it's always fun to watch the evolution of technology when it comes to outdoor sports.
In addition to my column, Tori McCormick wrote a story about a number of regulations, I think especially some border regulations, where they're examining, you know, maybe tweaking the rules a little bit. Tori, very lengthy story. Folks can read all the details on that. But there's a lengthy public comment period. There's an opportunity for the public to offer their opinions on these different regulations, I think, well into September. So, hey, democracy at work. Make your voice heard. Outdoor News Radio, Rob Jerisian with Tim Lesmeister. We're starting to wind down this week's broadcast. Hey, another deadline, Tim, September 5th. I want to remind listeners, if they are interested in picking up a doe permit in some of these areas, we've got more deer permit areas that are now lottery because the DNR is trying to grow the deer population. If you want to get a doe permit in those areas, you need to apply by September 5th. That's a deadline that hasn't been as important in recent years as the DNR was all for killing a lot of deer. But now we got to circle that one on the calendar again.
Oh, yeah. I can remember putting it on the calendar, making sure I had my application in time because we wanted to get as many antlerless tags as we possibly could. That way, when you first go out there, everybody gets to shoot at something right away. And then after you fill a few of those tags and you tighten up your program. But it's time. You got to be careful. If it gets by you, and we used to curse those hunters that would say, oh, you know, I forgot. Well, you're stuck with bucks. You know, you don't get to shoot any does. All the people that have a doe tag are going to get that. You're not. So definitely get your application in.
Tim, I haven't read Ryan Rothstein's piece yet, but you liked the photo that he had where he's mounted his deer trail camera on a pole. You think more and more astute deer hunters are doing that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm doing that now, too. You know, I'm always looking for the perfect tree to mount my trail cameras on, and I can never find it. It's always either so big I can't get the strap around it, or it's so small that I can't get the thing tight. And so now I've got a pole because my cameras have, you know, a little threaded screw thing on the back, and I can shove a bolt into it. And so I just literally drive poles in the ground exactly where I want my trail cams and then just screw it onto the pole. And it just works beautifully. And I think that's what you have to think about here when you're going out there with your trail cams. Am I going to get it exactly where I want it? You can. Just take out one of these fence posts and drive that into the ground and attach your camera to that. Works beautifully.
And real easy to move the pole, right? If after a couple of weeks you're like not pleased with what you're seeing on your camera, it's pull it up and move it. So that's
you should be moving those cameras as well. And Ryan talks about that. Don't just plant those cameras and hope a big deer walks by. If you've had that thing out there 4 days, 5 days, and you haven't seen what you want to see, move it because, you know, these deer use certain trails and they're doing certain things. And he said, pay attention to the rubs and the scrapes because, you know, that's where the bucks are.
Iowa story inside this week's print edition of Outdoor News. You're an old Iowa guy, Tim. Good to see the pheasant harvest up remarkably last year. Up, what, 62% from a year ago? Or from, I guess it would have been from 2022?
Habitat, habitat, habitat. Don't we talk about that a lot? Finally, we get into a situation where we've got good nesting. There's a lot of habitat. A lot of birds. When you get a lot of birds, you get a lot of hunters. When you get a lot of hunters, then you're going to see that ratio of birds killed go way up. So I think that's what we're dealing with now, is that we're seeing a lot of birds down in Iowa. I know we talked about this ad nauseum here 10 years ago when there were no birds in Iowa. And it seemed like they were never going to come back. Well, they have, in a big way. So if you want to get into some really good pheasant hunting, anywhere in Iowa now has been really, really good. And the landowners down there are pretty good about letting you on. That's one of the things I like about Iowa, is that, you know, tell them that you're going to go out and hunt pheasants on Saturday and come back Sunday morning and kill a few coyotes for them, and they'll let you on.
I might dispute the habitat thing with you there a little bit, Tim. I don't know. Every time I go across Iowa, it seems like I see less and less habitat. I think what benefited that state was 3 years of drought, and drought is good for pheasants and turkeys. I think back-to-back-to-back years of that helped boost pheasant numbers, and people were seeing the birds, and a lot of hunters went out, right? They sold a lot more licenses. It's been a wet year. I don't know if it's been as wet in Iowa as it's been here, but I think there's some folks worried about pheasant populations maybe not pulling off real good broods in 2024. I would be shocked, Tim, if the pheasant kill in Iowa in 2024 is as high as it was last year.
I'm not so sure, because, you know, it was a dry spring, so, and then the rains came. So I think a lot of the nesting may have occurred, and then what happened is you'll see those small ones might get into some delayed mortality. I call it just mortality. Because of the rains and the flooding and whatever they had. But I still think that the numbers, I think the nesting was probably good. And I think the roadside counts, we don't know. But the bottom line is I'm seeing a lot of birds when I'm going through Iowa. So I'm hoping another banner year.
Okay. Well, the rain in Minnesota, I'm pretty well convinced, probably hurt pheasant numbers here this year. Now, I don't know if they got as much in Iowa. The rain here was pretty bad timing for pheasants. We talked about how it really didn't get going until April and May, which wasn't good for ducks, right? The ducks looked down and didn't see any water and kept going. We've talked about that. But that's prime pheasant nesting season in Minnesota. I'm not optimistic about how our pheasants did in this state, but we shall see. Tim, finally, we had a Beyond Minnesota item about a bear attack in a tent out in north of Yellowstone. Was it in Montana? I forget the exact dateline, but it was at a private campground north of Yellowstone National Park. And I know you've got some opinions on this one.
Well, it was a black bear. And yes, it was north of Yellowstone in Montana. And a black bear mauled a three-year-old that was in the tent. And I'm thinking to myself, what would that little three-year-old have been wearing? What had that three-year-old been saying, the voice? What could have caused that bear to literally go into the tent and maul that poor little three-year-old? And then I started reading beyond that, and the ranger found garbage all around the campsite, a cooler that was probably open, human food that was actually in and around that tent, human food in the tent.
You can't
do that.
The
bear wasn't trying to maul that three-year-old. It was trying to get something to eat.
Yeah, they said they haven't had a problem with this bear before, but I mean those are real basic rules, and hey, we feel terrible for this kid. But I'm looks like I'm going to try to get into the Boundary Waters in September, Tim. And I mean, you got to hang your food obviously in a campground, so you just put the food in the car. But you can't have garbage, you can't have food around the tent. That is an absolute problem. You can't let that happen.
They're making coolers now that you can literally close and lock down and seal. The odors don't come out. You know, that's what you want in bear country. Keep the bears out of your campsite. Don't let them get in there, because, you know, they're not after your child. They're after the food.
Yeah, exactly. All right, Tim. Well, good advice. Thanks for spending a segment with me, and we'll talk to you again next week.
Sounds good. We'll catch up to you soon.
Our buddy Tim Lesmeister. Thank you to him, all of our other guests. I hope everybody enjoys a great week out of doors. I'm Rob Gerisline, signing off for Outdoor News Radio.
Missed a segment from this week's edition of Outdoor News Radio? You can hear a podcast of the complete program at OutdoorNews.com or via your favorite podcast streaming platforms. And for the rest of the story on the topics we cover here on the program, get yourself or a friend a subscription to Outdoor News. Just visit OutdoorNews.com. And don't forget to join us next week on this station to talk everything out of doors.